Syndicate Broadcasting.
Thursday. Well, finally have some good news. The publishing of my book is finally underway. Not quite available yet. It'll probably take another 2 weeks before it's finally officially available because I gotta they don't publish it until you get you gotta order a physical copy, you gotta review it, and then prove a bit, and you know, blah blah blah. But at least it's uploaded. It's on the printer's site. It's got an ISBN number. So finally. Jesus, I knew it would take a while. I didn't think it would take this long, but you know, it is the longest by far to date book I've ever written. So, and it's got the most quotations in it, so you know, it did require a lot more proofreading than anything I've ever worked on before. Anyway, so yeah, the process has begun. So a couple more weeks, guys, it should be finally available. That's just the printed version. I want to do a electronic version too. That's going to be a little more involving. Jesus Christ, it's a pain in the ass. I actually started with that one first. I thought that was going to be the easy thing to do, and then I would do the printed one. No. It's got to have basically a doctorate degree now just to, anyway. So I'll work on that later, but at least I'll have the printed version available pretty soon here. Anyway. Let's pick up where, let's see here. I'm not picking up. I'm starting fresh. We finished our discussion yesterday on the Hittites. So let's look at our next installment here on the Bronze Age, close of the Bronze Age, demise of civilizations. You know, there were many others that were taken down. I'll probably eventually get to all of them, but for now, in this current series, we'll end off with this discussion of Ugarit. Ugarit was an ancient Canaanite port city in northern Syria. It lies on the Mediterranean coast, some 7 miles north of Latakia, near modern-day Burj al Kasab. So the fact that it was a Canaanite city should tell you something right there. They wanted the Canaanites out. The entire Torah, really, that's all it's about, is Yahweh promising the Chosenites all of Canaan. I'll drive them out before you. You shall go in and lay waste to everything, kill everything that breathes, you know, blah, 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 blah. And we know that did happen. It happened to cities and city-states all over Canaan, but particularly Ugarit, which was the biggest major epicenter, major economic power at the time. It had some political, political and military clout as well, but as far as the tribe is concerned, its biggest focus was economics, removing economic threats to its global domination scheme, and Ugarit definitely was high on that list. Anyway, like so many other cities in the region at the close of the Bronze Age, Ugarit was absolutely devastated, leveled to the ground, and to a large extent, burnt to ashes by the heebie-jeebie-controlled Sea Peoples. A good deal of its population fled the city at this time, a pattern we've seen so familiarly with other cultures we've talked about at this time, fled the city to find refuge elsewhere. A good many of them did. Many of them died, but many of them also fled, probably catching word in advance because there were so many other invasions by the Sea Peoples. But we know a lot of people also fled from Hattusa, you know, the Hittite capital city, fled from China, they fled from the Indus Valley. Anyway, let's look at the importance of Ugarit in the Bronze Age. Obviously, it was important. It was a major trading epicenter, but let's go into this in some more detail here. Not only was it a port city, and at the entrance of the inland trade route to the Euphrates and Tigris highlands, but important religious center as well. The Canaanites, don't forget, were demonized, for, you know, amongst other things, primarily for religious reasons, just like the Hittites, right? They were evil heathens, pagans. They had to go just on that basis alone. The real reason, though, as far as the tribe was concerned, was economics. But they had to use the pagan, evil pagan religion factor, you know, to dupe the dumbass masses of Jews that fell for that crap so they could get them to go and fight for it. Not that at the highest levels, not that they gave a frog's fat ass about religion, you know. But they had to put that in there so that it wouldn't be known that it was only economics. Just like when we go to war today, guys, it's always either, you know, containing communism, as it was in the Cold War, or, you know, fighting terrorism, or, you know, blah, 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 spreading freedom and democracy, getting rid of a dictator. What is it, really? Protecting Jew prophets. That's all it is. It's all it's ever been thousands of years ago. All it is today, and that's all it's ever been every other time in between. They fund the wars, they orchestrate them, and then they turn around and use their propaganda machine to bullshit the ones that go and fight these sorry-ass fucking wars for no reason other than to fatten their wallets and increase their power, too. That's it. Everything else is bullshit. Everything else is window dressing. People fall for it every fucking time. Anyway, Ugarit reached its heyday between 1800 and 1200 BC when it ruled a trade-based coastal kingdom, trading with places like Egypt, Cyprus, the Aegean, Syria, the Hittites, of course, and much of the eastern Mediterranean. So it had quite an extensive trade network. You can see why it had to go, guys. Now, again, the Phoenicians had a very extensive trade network, even more so than Ugarit, but it was already in the tribe's pocket, so they didn't have to go. The first written evidence mentioning the city of Ugarit comes from the nearby city of Ebla, dating to about 1800 BC. Ugarit passed into the sphere of influence of Egypt, which, of course, exerted a deep influence on its art. Egypt influenced the art all over the Canaanite region. And even beyond that as well, of course, you know, the Egyptians influenced the Greeks, you know, the Minoans. Evidence of the earliest Ugaritic contact with Egypt and the first exact dating of Ugaritic civilization comes from a carnelian bead identified with the Middle Kingdom pharaoh Semisret I from 1971 to 1926 BC, going back that far. A stela, or a stone plaque, and a statuette from the Egyptian pharaohs Semisret III and Amenemhet the III also have likewise been found. So these two pharaohs also made reference to Ugarit. But it's unclear at what time these monuments were brought to Ugarit. Amarna letters from Ugarit, dating to about 1350 BC, record one note each from Amitamru I, Nicmadu II, and his queen. From the 16th to the 13th century BC, Ugarit remained in regular contact with Egypt and Alashiya, or Cyprus. What is Alashiya by the Egyptians? So, you know, as time went on, the contact became regular, the commerce became regular, routine. In the second millennium BC, Ugarit's population was mostly Amorite, and the Ugaritic language probably has a direct Amoritic origin. The Amorites, of course, are also mentioned in the Not-So-Holy Book. The Kingdom of Ugarit may have controlled about 1,200 square miles on average. So its sphere of influence was pretty broad. During some of its history, it would have been in close proximity to, if not directly within, the Hittite Empire. So there was a lot of crossover there. And thus they exchanged a lot of ideas, a lot of beliefs. You know, their religions were quite similar. A lot of their idols looked the same, slightly different name. But, you know, you got that, really, with all ancient world religions. They just borrowed back and forth from each other. You can see a common thread, really, running through all of their ancient mythologies and whatnot. Anyway, Ugarit clearly was an important commercial city, and it was close friends with two of the most hated peoples of the Hebes. Once again, the Amorites and the Hittites. Oh. They wanted all of them to go. Of course, and according to the Not-So-Holy Book, they did go. And according to the archaeological record, they did go. Of course, the people of Ugarit themselves were Canaanites, which are also mentioned in the Torah as living between one of the chief enemies of the Hebes. These are the reasons why the city of Ugarit was targeted at the end of the Bronze Age. Now, the name Ugarit is not mentioned in the Old Testament, not that I know of. It might be there, you know, under a different title. That was very common in the ancient world. You know, one culture would have a different name for a group of people than the name they used for themselves. Sometimes it was a derogatory name. Sometimes it was just a nickname. You know, the Egyptians were famous for doing that. You know, they didn't call the that The Hittites, you know, Hittites, for example, they refer to them as the Hatti. Just for one example. Over the centuries, the Egyptians had different names for the tribe. I got a show coming up on the Shasu guys. I'm convinced the Shasu actually was another name for the proto-Israelites. I used to believe that they were influenced by them, but I'm leaning more in the direction that that's actually who they were before they became known. You know, of course, another name for them after they were called Shasu and before they were called Israelites was, of course, the Hyksos, the Asiatics from the area of Shalem, Jerusalem. So at different times and also in different places, their names changed, but you can tell who they are. You know, you keep digging and you realize, oh, son of a gun, that's them. Yeah, they were from the same area, you know, blah, 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 blah. But a lot of people get confused, you know, because sometimes there's no phonetic relationship at all between the different names. And so people think it's different people. Hibiru is another name used by the Egyptians to describe these same bastards. Later on, they were, in fact, known as the Hebrew. The Egyptian version is Hibiru. Exactly the same people. Anyway, let's take a look now at the destruction of Ugarit. The last Bronze Age king of Ugarit, Amurapi, who reigned roughly around 1215 to 1180 BC, was a contemporary of the Hittite king Supalumiana the second. So, yeah, his reign was right at the very end. Bronze Age ended roughly, you know, 1177 BC. And so his reign came right to 1180. A lot of the cultures that were destroyed at the end of the Bronze Age, you know, they weren't all destroyed right in 1177, around that time, within a decade or so in either direction. So, yeah, his reign came right to that period. The exact dates of his reign are not known. These are approximate. and that's the case, guys, with any date, really, that they assign to the ancient world. They're always approximate. There's always some leeway. Some archaeologists are real sticklers, though, and if they can't get a find to match up with the date of a known pharaoh or something, then they think, oh, no, there was no connection here. You know, that doesn't match up with that story. So what a bunch of crap that is. Those dates are loose. They're wide open. Wide open. You know, I've talked about this before. Even some heretic Egyptologists have admitted that. I mentioned David Rohl, R-O-H-L. He's, he's a tribe member. But nevertheless, wrote a very good book. They did a series based around it on the Discovery Channel back in the late 90s. His book is called Pharaohs and Kings. Very good. His main premise is that, yes, the whole timeline that's used by archaeologists is off by several centuries. And he more than adequately proves that in his book. Anyway. And they're off for other reasons, too, not just because they don't take into account the fact that there were pharaohs that overlapped each other, or sometimes one pharaoh would die and there wasn't a new pharaoh for several years, or two pharaohs that simultaneously reigned. You know, they act like each pharaoh followed in sequence right after the one after the other, you know, and each dynasty followed one after the other. No, sometimes there were 10, 15, 20, even 100 years that separated one dynasty from another, or one king from another. So that when you add it up, you've got at least 300 years discrepancy there, if not more. But they're wrong with their time frame for other reasons too, because they rely heavily on, carbon-14 dating, which, you know, it's like flip a coin as to whether or not it's reliable. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. There's a lot of factors that play in. So it's not a fail-safe, method of dating. There aren't any fail-safe methods, really. Although carbon-14 is certainly more reliable than regular radioisotope dating, as I mentioned before, that they use for fossils. That's a fucking joke right there. Toss that completely out the window. Laughable. There's no science there at all. Anyway, a letter by this last Hittite king is preserved, in which Amenrapi stresses the seriousness of the crisis faced by many Near Eastern states, from invasion by advancing sea peoples. He pleaded for assistance in this letter from King Alashia, highlighting the desperate situation that Ugrit was facing. And here's what he said. "My father, behold, the enemy's ships came here. My cities were burned, and they did evil things in my country. Does not my father know that all my troops and chariots are in the land of Hatti?" That's the Hittites. "And all my ships are in the land of Luka. Thus, the country is abandoned to itself. May my father know it. The seven ships of the enemy that came here inflicted much damage upon us." So you can just sense his desperation here. I mentioned how the Egyptians called the Hittites the Hatti, but that was common in other lands as well, as you can see here with Ugarit. But anyway, look at the desperation, guys. "They've come and done evil things in my country." Doesn't that sound familiar? "They have burned my cities." Unfortunately, no help arrived as a result of this plea, and the city was burned to the ground. By excavating the highest levels of the city's ruins, archaeologists can study various attitudes of Ugaritic civilization just before their destruction, and compare artifacts with those of nearby cultures to help establish dates, loose dates, but dates nonetheless. Ugarit also contained many caches of cuneiform tablets, actual libraries that contained a wealth of information. So we know a fairly good deal about what had gone on at this time. A cuneiform tablet found in 1986, for example, shows that Ugarit was destroyed after the death of Pharaoh Merneptah around 1203 BC. Merneptah is the pharaoh that wrote that famous stela there, in which he mentions Israel. Israel is devastated. He's the one who defeated the sea peoples. They tried to take Egypt down, remember, like so many other countries, and they didn't succeed with Egypt. Merneptah is the guy that kicked their ass, and he proudly portrayed that on this famous Merneptah stela, in which, amongst all the other conquered sea peoples, he mentions Israel by name, folks. In fact, some call it the Israel stela because of that. So they were definitely, unquestionably involved with these invasions. That's not open for debate. Not a conjecture. It's not a theory. Anyway, whether or not Ugarit was destroyed before or after Hattusa, the capital of the Hittites, is debated. But it was pretty, both destructions were in pretty close proximity to each other time-wise. Anyway, before the destruction even took place, it was preceded by, surprise of all surprises, a famine. Doesn't that sound familiar? You can bet this was a man-made famine. In fact, it was probably their first attempt to take it down, and when they realized, ah, crap, it's not going to work. All right, we need a full-scale invasion. They probably feared, a full-scale invasion because they were a pretty formidable enemy. The Egyptians had some battles with Ugarit early on, and they put up quite a fight. So they're probably hoping to avoid that, but when they realized the famine didn't work, that's when they amassed, a tremendous amount of forces to go in there. Anyway, it would appear indeed that the tribe did try to take Ugarit down with this first attempt here of a manufactured famine. One of their favorite tricks of all time, right? They've been doing that all through the centuries, right up into modern times. This famine also affected the Hittites and other surrounding regions. But here, of course, we'll only be focusing on the effects thereof on Ugarit. One letter, which was written by Ugarit King Emetamru II, 1260 to 1235 BC, to Egypt's Ramses II, made these remarks. To the great king, the pharaoh, to the king of kings, my lord, Ami has arrived to me, I think it was an Egyptian ambassador or whatever, has arrived to me the messenger of the son of the great king, my lord. Yeah, he was an ambassador. Now I, your servant, was delighted about it with regard to the grain deliveries that my lord is so beneficent and benevolent. And behold, the son, my lord, has given us to eat. The son, the great king, my lord, is indeed benevolent. So he's thanking the pharaoh here for sending foodstuffs, much needed foodstuffs, because they were in the midst of a tremendous famine just prior to their sea people invasion. How much you want to bet, guys? Tribal bastards, probably dried up a river and, orchestrated a blockade, a trade embargo or whatever, and drift them into, starvation mode. And luckily, Egyptian pharaoh came through for them. All right, guys, short break. Stick with us. Be right back.
Gives us one side of World War II. They don't want us to know the real history of what happened over 70 years ago, seeing through the eyes of the German victims. The horror of the terror bombing, the mass rape of millions of women and children, the torture and murder of civilians, the death camps for surrendered soldiers, the ethnic cleansing of whole countries, and the planned extermination of the entirety of the German people. After watching Hellstorm, you'll never see the good war and the good guys in the same light ever again. Watch for free and get DVDs at hellstormdocumentary.com. We'll be right back.
All right, guys, welcome back. Yeah, things are going to get very interesting here. Though the city of Ugarit was hurting for food at this time, the Hittites apparently were in even worse shape. This next letter excerpt we're going to be looking at was sent to an Ugarit king by a Hittite king, pleading with him for assistance. I'm including this excerpt here because it demonstrates that this famine was indeed of human origin. Listen to what this Hittite king said to the king of Ugarit. The city was looted. Our food on the threshing floors was burnt, and the vineyards were destroyed. So there you go. That was the cause of the famine at this same time that the Hittites were suffering. So how much you want to bet the famine that was being experienced in Ugarit was brought about by human hands as well, if you can call them humans? Absolutely, guys. My God, man. How many times has this gone on? Look at the potato famine with the Irish and the 19th century tribal fingerprints, all the hell over that. Look at the famine, the Ukraine Holocaust and the famine that they suffered. Again, all tribal orchestrated. On and on and on it goes, guys, down to the centuries. Their crimes are just absolutely jaw-dropping. Look at how after World War II, they wanted to poison and kill, they mentioned, 6 million Germans. Fortunately, that particular crime didn't come to fruition, but they fully intended to do it. It was actually a documentary done on that. I think it was on the History Channel. Very interesting. I don't know how that thing ever made it on TV, but very good documentary. Anyway, about this same time, another letter was sent from Ugarit's House of Urtinu, which was like their capital building, to an Ugarit official. And the letter stated, "There is famine in our house. We will all die of hunger. If you do not quickly arrive here, we ourselves will die of hunger. You will not see a living soul from our land." They were indeed in a very desperate situation. And it's obvious why. This was not some terrible natural calamity where the rivers flooded the croplands or where the sun baked and burnt their croplands because it didn't rain for days or weeks on end. No. All man-made. We just read where the Hittite famine at the same time was man-made. Destroyed the crops, burnt the produce they had on the threshing floors. There was also a letter from Pharaoh Merneptah that was found in the house of Urtinu that mentioned, quote, "consignments of grain sent from Egypt to relieve the famine in Ugarit." So Egypt was doing its best to try to help out. Why wasn't Egypt suffering a famine at this time? Not too far away. How did they escape if this was supposed to be a natural thing? No, it wasn't natural, guys. It was man-made. God damn it. Egypt wasn't suffering a famine because they weren't attacking them that way. They planned from the start. They knew it was going to have to be military. They couldn't even get into the country to en masse enough to do what they were doing, in Ugarit. And with the, with the Hittites. Don't forget, the tribe guys had been banished from Egypt. I'm sure a few slipped through the radar, but for the most part, they didn't want their asses anywhere near. They had their radar up pretty strong. And even though surely a few got in there, there wasn't enough in number to be able to take Egypt down from within again. Egypt got too wise to them. They tried it, you know, with the Hyksos. It worked for a while, but they kicked their asses out. They tried it again with Akhenaten, don't forget. They finally caught on to him and threw his ass the hell out. Anyway, one unidentified Ugarit official wrote a letter stating, "Here with me, plenty has become famine." In other words, where we once had plenty, now it's famine. There was also a text from the king of Tyre, Phoenician king, to the king of Ugarit, stating that a ship belonging to the Ugaritic king, which was returning from Egypt loaded with grain, had gotten caught in a storm. You got to wonder if that was actually true, guys. You got to wonder, because don't forget, at this time, the Phoenicians were heavily involved with the tribe. They were deeply in bed with the tribe. So was he lying to them? Did they, in fact, intercept this ship bringing needed supplies from Egypt? Did they intercept it? Did they loot it, kill its occupants, and now they're just saying, oh, it was caught in a storm? Anyway, here's what he wrote. "Your ship that you sent to Egypt died in a mighty storm." Yeah, there you go, died. So it's not that just that it got delayed. It ain't coming, baby. Yeah, how much you want to bet they intercepted it? "Died in a storm close to Tyre." Oh, how convenient. "It came near Tyre's border and they seized it." Yeah, on behalf of their little tribal masters. How much you want to bet, guys, that's what happened. "It was recovered and the salvage master took all the grain from their jars. But I have taken all their grain, all their people, and all their belongings from the salvage master, and I have returned it all to them. And now your ship is being taken care of in Akko, stripped." Well, okay, so now he's accounting for the cargo, but he says, "I've taken it." Well, what are you doing with it then? Why isn't he sending it? Why didn't he say he was sending it? He's supposed to be giving him assurance here. "Yeah, don't worry, I seized it, I got it all." Did he ever send it? Did they ever get it? Probably not. Anyway, this letter clearly indicates that there was an attempt to intercept the grain shipment to Ugarit. How much you want to bet, guys, it wasn't actually caught in a storm. They seized it. He's trying to, again, just making the story up. Anyway. Let's see. Anyway, let's look at some further interesting historical testimonies here. It would appear that the last king of Ugarit, Amurapi there, mentioned it before, was actually a traitor who, as it turns out, apparently collaborated with the Heb-led Sea Peoples in helping to bring his own city down. In one letter, a certain person named Esuwaru, who was a high dignitary or a senior governor of the kingdom of Alesia, had wrote to this Ugaritic king saying, quote, "As for the matter concerning those sea people enemies, it was the people from your country and your own ships who did this," the attacks on Ugarit. "And it was the people from your country who committed these aggressions." How do you like that? Isn't that an interesting twist? What a kick in the ass. Did he actually assist with the looting of his own? For all we know, guys, he wasn't actually even a Canaanite. Maybe he was a heebie-jeebie who infiltrated his way to the throne and for a time fooled people into thinking he was, you know, ruling in their favor and their interests. And then at the last minute, when the situation was most desperate, then he turns on them. And by then, so many people were starving, nobody could do anything about it at that point, right? But in this letter, he's being accused of the very one who was behind, you know, assisting the sea people raids. Him and his own ships. Very interesting. Sounds like our modern tribal sellout leaders, does it? Does it not? Anyway, if Merapi really was a traitor, it would appear that he himself was ultimately betrayed. For he wrote the following letter of distress to the king of Alesia, apparently in response to the letter we just read. He said, "My father," notice how they always addressed each other as "my father," like, you know, when they're trying to kiss up to them or want something from them or whatever. "My father, now the enemy ships are coming and they burn down my towns with fire. They have done unseemly things in the land." So, you know, probably a lot of immoral stuff too. After they come in and started setting fire to everything and devastating everything, and probably there's probably rapes going on and just all kinds of heinous crimes. "My father," he said, "is not aware," he's talking to him, his father, "my father is not aware of the fact that all the troops of my father's overlord are stationed in Hatti," the Hittite territory, "and that all my ships are stationed in Lucca. They still have not arrived, and the country is lying like that," laying in a big mess, in other words. "Now, seven ships that are approaching have done evil things to us. Now then, if there are any enemy ships, send me a report somehow so that I will know." So it seems pretty desperate here. Or you could argue maybe he's just trying to save his own skin, so he won't be seen as a traitor later, to his own people. "What do you mean I was in on the attacks? I wrote you a letter telling you that, we were being attacked." Who knows? Who knows what to believe? But something's very fishy here. Anyway, regardless whether he was a traitor or not, Ugarit dealt with some horrible sufferings at this time. So this attack took place while Ugarit's defenses were stationed elsewhere. Look at the timing, guys. Timing. He said his ships, or his fighting men, you know, were elsewhere. They were stationed in Lucca. So they planned this thing just right, didn't they? They probably arranged for the king to have his ships sent to Lucca, so they could more easily launch this attack. Anyway, the king of Alesia wrote back to the Ugaritic king saying, quote, "Concerning what you wrote to me, they have spotted enemy ships at sea. If they have indeed spotted ships, make yourself as strong as possible. Fortify yourself. Now, where are your own troops and chariotry stations?" he asks. "Are they not stationed with you? If not, who will deliver you from the enemy?" Apparently, this letter got to him before he received the king's letter, because he's acting like he didn't know where they were stationed. Anyway, "surround your towns," he says, "with walls," fortification walls. "Bring troops and chariotry with you inside, then wait at full strength for the enemy," hoping, you know, to catch them with a surprise defense that they didn't anticipate. Archaeological evidence confirms the extent of the devastation that Ugarit suffered at this time. A layer of up to 2 meters thick of ash in some places serves as clear evidence of the destruction of the city by fire, as can also be seen amongst other places in the royal palace. Burned plaster, heaps of ash, ceilings and terraces found collapsed and crushed, and walls transformed into piles of rubble. The city was indeed devastated. Also found were many arrowheads scattered throughout the ruins, sometimes embedded in stone, sometimes embedded in bone. In an explored area of 1,500 square meters, 25 arrow tips were discovered and 30 arrowheads just in that one fairly small area. Obviously, there was a violent spate of street fighting that had broken out, right inside the city, which forced the people to flee Ugarit in a hurry. Chaos, just like we've seen with so many of these other cities and city-states at this time. And ultimately, guys, just like with Hattusa, just like with so many other cities at this time, Ugarit was brought to a complete and final end. A lot of the people escaped. They weren't wiped out themselves, but the civilization certainly was. It never rose again. The fact, though, that the relatively few skeletons that there were relatively few skeletons found in the streets tells us that a good many, fortunately, did flee the city in time, probably before the invasion ever even began, getting a warning ahead of time. But, even though I'm sure they would have preferred to have wiped them all out, their main aim was simply to take their empire down and to remove them as a competitive threat. And that's what it accomplished. That's what it accomplished, all right. And the very fact that even though they didn't extinguish them, they scattered them abroad. So that, they weren't able really to rebuild so easily and become, the threat, certainly not the type of threat that they were before. Let's look at the Hypero or Hypero in the Amarna letters. Again, obviously a reference to the tribe. The Amarna letters contain numerous pleas from Canaanite kings to Egyptian pharaohs for help against the attacking Hypero Hebrews. A lot of the letters coming into Egypt pleading for help at this time, the close of the Bronze Age, specifically mentioned help from the Hypero. The Hebrews, guys. Isn't that interesting? The Egyptians called them the Sea Peoples, but other surrounding cities and city-states writing to Egypt referred to them as the Hypero. Why? Because they were led by them. So even though there were different peoples involved in these invasions that the Hebrews used, bribed, coerced, whatever, to do their fighting for them, they knew who the kingpins were, the string pullers were. And so they just labeled them all as Hypero. In one letter from Rib Hada, the ruler of the city of Gubla, or Byblos, as it was later called, this king thusly begged the pharaoh to come to his aid and to rescue him from the Hypero threat. He said, "What am I who live among Hypero to do if the king or the pharaoh, my lord, does not give heed to the words of his servant? Then all the lands of the king as far as Egypt will be jointed to the Hypero." In other words, they're going to control everything. If you don't do something, Pharaoh, even your land is going to be devastated. And it pretty much was. It wasn't taken down, but it was greatly reduced, right? So this warning was very true. Very true. Anyway. But notice, guys, the very specific mention of Hypiru or Hibiru, that is absolutely unquestionably the Hebes. Another Egyptian vassal king, Myarzana, who was ruler of the city of Hasi, similarly entreated the pharaoh for his assistance. He said the Hibiru captured Mazyptu, a city of the king, my lord, another one of Egypt's underling provinces, and they plundered it, sent it up in flames, and then the Hibiru took refuge with Amenhapti, the ruler of the city of Tushaltu. And the Hibiru captured, don't forget, guys, I did a show many moons ago, I think it was back on Oracle, on the great fires through the centuries, starting back with, BC times and coming right up on up into the present. Oh, there were at least, I don't know, 24 that I covered. And I showed how their fingerprints were on every single one of them. You know, that there were times where they were being expelled from this country or being forced into ghettos in that country or laws were being passed to restrict their ability to engage in commerce or in business, in finance, or to be involved in politics, whatever. No sooner did something like that happen and bang! The city where these laws were passed suddenly now is aflame. And so here now we see, going way back here to over 3,000 years ago, they were doing the same goddamn thing, weren't they? Setting flame to city after city. Anyway, this letter continues. And the Hibiru captured Gilumu, a city of the king, another one of Pharaoh's vassals. The king, my lord, again, meaning the pharaoh, they plundered it, sent it up in flames, and hardly one family escaped from Gilunu. So look at that, guys. The Hebes were setting flames to these two cities here, and hardly any families escaped. They were targeting civilians. These fires weren't to just take out the military or even the economic centers. These were ethnic cleansing fires. See, they felt that they could get away with the more wholesale destruction here because these were small cities that didn't have, large defensive operations, right? They didn't have a big army. So why not? They won't be able to defend themselves. So let's kill them all. When it came to cities like Ugarit, right? They had to make sure that their warriors were out of the country, so they had them sent to Luku, to get them out of the city. They didn't have to do that here. And so since they were defenseless, what better opportunity to ethnic cleanse? So they set the thing ablaze and took out families, civilians, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, we got a call on the line. You there, caller?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear, man.
Oh, okay, just listening in. I just listening in. Thanks, Charlie.
Yeah, no problem. I'll put you on mute here. So, anyway, this letter goes on to say, then the Hibiru took refuge with Amenhapte, the local king, and the Hibiru captured Magdalu, a city of the king, my lord, my god, my son, plundered it, sent it up in flames, and hardly one family escaped from Magdalu. So there's a third city now with this same pattern repeated. Burnt it to the ground, hardly one family escaped. And he's reminding the pharaoh that these are your cities, pharaoh. You know, he's pleading with him, help, help, come, send me some assistance before I'm next. Now, in this case, it wasn't the pharaoh was being hard-hearted, inconsiderate, or whatever. He had his own affairs to tend with. Because at that time, Egypt was being attacked by the Sea People's guys. The letter went on to say, then the High Bureau took refuge with Amenhotep and Ushtu, a city of the king, my lord. The High Bureau captured, plundered it, and sent it up in flames. Then the High Bureau took refuge with Amenhotep again. And then the High Bureau, having raided Hasi, a city of the king, my lord, we did battle with the High Bureau and we defeated them. Wow. At least that small local band of them, anyway. How do you like that? But how many was that now? Four or five? I lost count. Either four or five cities were mentioned here as being burnt to the ground, families not being able to escape. Look at the evils, guys, that they've gotten away with. And these are just the ones that have survived the ravages of not only the elements, but of deliberate tribal purges, you know. Amazingly, records like this have still managed to survive. One of the reasons that this survived or that they made it known public is because most people don't know, or they have gone to great lengths to make sure most people don't know that the High Bureau are actually out of Hebrew. But nevertheless, guys, it's amazing how much has survived to our day. But can you imagine how much has not survived? Can you imagine how much worse their trail of crime really is from what we know? What we know is jaw-dropping enough, but you can bet your fat fanny it's a hell of a lot worse than what we're able to glean from these few remaining scraps that have survived. This is bad. This is very bad. I mean, looking at what happened at the end of the Bronze Age, this is mind-bogglingly bad, but it's nothing compared to what to know the real record must be. All right, guys, another break. Grab back.
Judah P. Benjamin, the first professing Jew to be elected to the United States Senate. Judah. See how efficiently he ran his sugarcane plantation with 140 slaves. Judah. Imagine his courage as he resigned from the United States Senate to serve as Secretary General, Secretary of War, and later as Secretary of State for the Confederacy. His image is on Confederate money. Judah. Watch as Jews help in his spectacular escape after the war ended, and enjoy how the Rothschild dynasty rewarded the first Jew in the U.S. Senate for protecting their financial investment in the African slave industry and effort to destroy the United States. Judah. Coming this fall.
No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone. You're just a melody breaker.
Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Guys, welcome back. So anyway, a Canaanite ruler whose name is not legible on the ancient clay tablet wrote to the Pharaoh and made this plea. He said, "May the king, my lord, know that the mayors that were in the major cities of my lord are gone. And the entire land of the king, my lord, has deserted to the Hibiru." They sold out. They were probably given an ultimatum, join with us or we're going to kill you. And so they joined with them. And so now their army of mercenaries grew even larger to conduct more invasions. This is probably what they did everywhere they went. Some of the ones that, you know, didn't escape, the ones that they didn't kill, that they took as prisoners, they gave them, an ultimatum. Die or join us. So, you know, this is how the Sea Peoples, I'm sure, were able to grow in such large numbers enough to take on so many cities like this, you know, effectively. They joined with the Hibiru, he said. Another Canaanite ruler, Yapahu, the governor of the city of Gazru, had thusly pleaded with the Pharaoh. He said, "May the king, my lord, the sun from the sky, take thought for his land. Since the Hibiru are stronger than we are," because, again, they had all of these recruits, right? "Since they are stronger than we are, may the king, my lord, give me his help, and may the king, my lord, get me away from the Hibiru, lest the Hibiru destroy us." Wow. Hey, at least they knew who the enemy was back then. Still another Canaanite ruler, Shub Andu, had pleaded with the Pharaoh, saying, "As the Hibiru are more powerful than we, may the king take cognizance of his lands." Wow. See why they hated the Canaanites, guys. Canaanites didn't play their little game. They didn't give in. They wouldn't give up their independence, and they wouldn't go down without a fight. And they had a powerful ally in Egypt. The Canaanite king, Dagon Takala, likewise wrote, "Save me from the powerful enemies, from the hand of the Hibiru, the robbers," it says. "Save me, great king, my lord, and behold, I have written to you. Moreover, you, great king, my lord, save me or I will be lost to you, the great king." Look at this, guys. How many letters is this now that we've read, which come out and name the bastards by name? Here's another one. This one's written by another Canaanite king, unnamed, to an Egyptian pharaoh. Sometimes it might be the same king on different occasions, but anyway. May the king, my lord, know that the chief of the Habiru has besieged the lands which your God has given me, but I have attacked him. Also, let the king, my lord, know that none of my allies have come to my aid. Yeah, they probably turned him against him. It is only I and Abdu-Heba, another king, who fight against the Habiru and their chief. Imagine that, guys. Unbelievable. Remember, you know, in the Torah, all these promises were made, right? We read them, you know, yesterday. You shall take the land and possess it, blah, 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 blah. The land of Canaan, the promised land. That's what we're talking about here. Ugarit was the epicenter of the promised land, right, of Canaan. You shall take it. You shall possess it. You shall overcome them. And, you know, many people who mock the Bible, and rightly so, but sometimes they wrongly mock the Bible. They'll say, how could a small little tribe like the Hebrews possibly have taken over the Canaanites? They admit that a lot of Canaanite cities did fall at the close of the Bronze Age, but they'll say, no, 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 no. That's just, you know, the writers of the Bible took the stories that they knew about the Canaanites being attacked by the sea peoples, and they wrongly applied it to themselves. No, actually, they didn't. They didn't. They didn't do that at all. It happened exactly the way we read about in the Torah. It did. Now, it wasn't them, the great warriors, single-handedly. No, no. Hell no. The pussies that they are. Very few of them actually went on the battlefield. You can bet your sweet ass of that. But they led the pack, guys. They were the ones orchestrating it, just like today, just like always, right? They're the big financiers behind the curtain, funding it all, instigating it all, leading out the whole damn thing. That's all true. So when you read the Torah, yes. How is it possible for a small little tribe to pull this off? Because they created alliances. They created a network of minions that they either bribed or coerced or threatened, whatever, it doesn't matter. They got them to do their fighting for them. All for them, though. All for them. It's like all the wars that are fought in today, guys. Who are they fighting for, God damn it? You don't even know. So pathetic, so disgusting. Anyway. So these destroyers of civilization were pretty busy, were they not? But do notice that these cutthroats, these thieves, these crooks were involved in the very activity that the biblical Hebrews were said to have been involved in right after their expulsion from Egypt, the Hyksos expulsion. Now, you know, I got to mention this. When you read the Not-So-Holy Book, you get the impression that, yeah, the Canaanite invasion took place right after the expulsion from Egypt, the Hyksos expulsion. But there were, in fact, several centuries that separated the Hyksos expulsion from the demise of the Bronze Age civilizations that we're talking about here. But you can explain that in two different ways. Either A, the biblical chronology is all fucked up, and most likely that's what it is. The Bible didn't take into consideration those 700 years gap because the people who wrote it later didn't even probably fucking know the history that well. They're just passing on oral traditions, whatever. Or another option is the expulsion mentioned in the book of Exodus, which was immediately followed by this, post-Bronze Age demise of civilizations, refers to the expulsion under Akhenaten. That could be, although, you know, it seems pretty likely that the amount of tribal bastards expelled from Egypt at that time was not as anywhere near as great as the Hyksos expulsion. But nevertheless, that could be what it's talking about, because there were two expulsions of the tribe. Remember, they tried to, you know, regain control of Egypt. They did for a time. Akhenaten's reign was at least 17 years. Some say a little more than that, but at least 17 years. And all during that time, they were flocking in there, baby. Oh, yeah. To Goshen, as the Old Testament refers to Armana. So they did flock there in fairly large numbers. It could have been as high as what the Hyksos expulsion was. I don't know. I don't think it was. But in any case, so there's two ways of explaining that. In any case, there's no question that the invasion of Canaan, or, you know, the promised land mentioned in the book of Exodus, does without question correspond with what we're talking about here, which we know from the archaeological record did take place. Yes, it was the sea peoples doing it, but who let out in this? You just read, you just heard me read all of these quotes from these Amarna letters, right? It was the Habiru, baby, the Hebes. They led the whole damn thing out. That's why a lot of archaeologists, you know, they try to get you to think that, oh, no, there's no evidence that the Habiru were the Hebrew. Oh, cut the shit. And it's not just phonetic similarity, you know, with those two words, Hebrew and Habiru. It's because of the modus operandi, the area they came from. I mean, just on and on and on. There's no fucking question. And then when you see who led out, you know, who was allied with the Phoenicians, the reason why the Phoenicians weren't attacked, it was because they were in bed with the Hebes and were dominating the whole goddamn world trade scene, guys. So do they really not know that the Hebes were the Hiberu? You know, are they just that stupid? You really think that's stupid? They know. Better believe they know. Anyway, as we did last night, let us now look at the biblical record of this whole thing now. The mentality behind the raping and pillaging of Canaan by the Habiru is best summed up in the following passages where the Yahweh double declares. This first one is Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 to 5. Here the great Yah prick says, when the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it. Again, Canaan, the land of Ugarit, right? Notice how the Yah prick here says, I'm bringing you into this land to possess it, to steal it. And when he clears away many nations before you, you shall utterly destroy them. Here, Yahweh is saying that he's going to clear away many nations. Who did the clearing away? The sea peoples, right? Once the clearing away was done, now Yahweh says, I want you to utterly destroy them. In other words, they're going to come in and clear out, you know, if there's any military there, they're going to come in and clear them out. And then from there, that's not enough. From there, you're to finish the job by utterly destroying. And we know they were, guys. Again, the archaeological record tells us. In some cases, they were several feet thick, meters in some areas, thick of ash, crumbled stone, bones galore, arrowheads all over the place. Thoroughly devastated them, just like this little bastard called for. Does it not make you want to vomit when you realize that Bible dumbasses read these stories, guys, in the Torah and cheer it on and think it's wonderful? See how God protects and comes to the aid, comes to the rescue of his people when they have faith in him. No question is raised as to whether this was a just cause. No objection is raised over the fact that little kids, women, elderly, whole families were involved in this. They don't give a fucking shit, guys, because in their demented fucking duke down brains, they think that this is all justified because it was commanded by a loving God. Don't you just want to puke, preferably right in their face? The Outprick went on to say, you shall make no covenant with them. In other words, don't work out any agreements with them. Wipe them out. Now, we know that at least in one case, we just read one letter where there was an agreement. They were given the option, surrender, join ranks with us, and we won't kill you. But here was Yahweh saying, don't even bother doing that. These are so vile and evil. Just kill them all. Kill them all. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. Well, they did do that on numerous occasions, but in any case, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, i.e., they will eventually become an economic threat to us again. So wipe them out. That was the real motive behind writing this horse shit. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you. In other words, if you don't do exactly as I'm telling you and kill them all, wipe them all out, the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you and he will quickly destroy you. In other words, make sure you destroy all of them. You know, if this royal prick in the sky was so concerned about having them all destroyed, why didn't he just wave his magic willy and do the fucking job himself? You know what I'm saying? Look how fucking lame this is. Not only is it disgusting and immoral and just vomit-inducing, but look how lame this is. This fucking incompetent little prick couldn't do it himself. He had to tell them to do it. I mean, give me a fucking break, guys. And if you don't wipe them out completely, I'm going to wipe you all out. Can you not see that monstrous bastards were behind the writing of this that had no interest in religion at all? They were just using religion to twist people. You honestly think, you fucking dumbass Bible dupes, that a loving God is going to petition people to go on a mass killing spree for him? I mean, are you fucking serious? And if you don't kill them all, I'm going to kill you. Oh, if you can't see a fire-breathing dragon behind that, if you can't see a bunch of money and power-hungry Jews behind that kind of horse shit, you've got some serious mental issues. Look at this for what it is. As painful as it might be, having give up all of those little fantasy beliefs you have of rising from the dead with Jesus one day, it's got to go, God damn it. It's causing you to embrace all kinds of toxic beliefs. It has perverted and completely corrupted your understanding of a whole lot of things. It's gotten you to look with no sympathy, no compassion for the death of these untold thousands and thousands, probably tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people. There's no way we'll ever know how many people died at this time. When you include what went on in China, the Americas, and the Indus Valley, oh, it was millions, you can bet. 250,000 fled China at this time. You can just imagine all the misery and suffering created just at this time. And yet, you as a Bible dupe have no sympathy for any of them because you think that these were evil people that Yahweh was purging. Get the fuck out of here. Who's the real evil one here? And guess what? Once you come to the realization, or unless you come to the realization that the evil ones here were the Habiru and their little prick Yahweh deity, then that makes you evil, doesn't it? For supporting this and justifying it and not showing sympathy to these people that suffered so tremendously, many of which were your fucking ancestors, I might add. That makes you evil, doesn't it? If you embrace this, if you endorse it, if you defend it, that makes you evil. Of course it does. You may as well have been there participating in it. You sanction it. You cannot sanction shit like this and call yourself a fucking human being. How does that grab you? That's how serious it is to part ways with this goddamn book. It turns you into a fucking animal just like them if you in fact embrace this kind of shit and defend it. You're a fucking animal. Buy yourself a yarmulke, grow some locks, and get yourself a black top hat. Fucker, man. You see why I say you have to hate this book. Not just not believe in it. You gotta fucking hate it and everything it stands for. It's fucking pure evil. Oh, there goes my blood pressure again. I can feel it. How can your blood pressure not go up, though, when you talk about this shit, guys? What they get away with and continue to get away with. Passage goes on. But you shall do to them, you shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and hew down their Asherim. That's the altars to Asherah, which, don't forget, was fucking Yahweh's wife originally, right? And burn their graven images with fire. Oh, please. And he said that because, of course, he or, you know, the Jewish fucking orchestrators of this goddamn horseshit said this so that, you know, they would only worship the one true God, Yahweh, the good God. Oh, yeah, he's the good God. Look what he's commanding here, son of a bitch. But he's the good one. He's the moral one. Get the fuck out of here. Can't you see that everything this tribe has ever produced, ever offered to us, has been horseshit? All of it! Don't give me that fucking crap that it's just the Kabbalah and the Talmud and the, you know, the Zohar. It's this fucking book, too. God damn. This was where it all originated. All those other fucking writings were just following suit with this shit. Here's another one, Deuteronomy 20, 16 to 18. Only in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes. Well, from the archaeological record, they clearly didn't follow that instruction completely because there were some survivors. Well, actually, no, come to think of it, we know a lot of them fled and they have found a lot of skeletons half burned, some of them with, you know, arrows in them. They probably didn't leave anything alive, come to think of it, except for that one letter we just read where some obviously surrendered. They gave themselves over to the Hibiru. They used them to, you know, invade cities. And then later, they probably fucking killed them too, right? Isn't that what they always do? Thanks for fighting for us, suckers! Now we're going to give you the shaft too. Look at the soldiers, guys, in this country that have fought so many wars for them. And then, you know, within a decade or two or three, they're dying from fucking cancer because they gave them injections or had them breathe, you know, some toxic waste shit, depleted uranium or Agent Orange or... Jesus fucking Christ, man. Anyway, passage goes on. I am giving them to you as your inheritance. You shall not leave alive anything that breathes, but you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite, i.e. the Ugarit people, and the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that you may not teach to do according to all their detestable things which they have done for their gods. Oh, really now? Did you catch that? I want you to kill them all because of all the detestable things they did for their gods. Really? And what exactly were those detestable things, you little prick? You little prick in the sky? And yet all the while, look what this detestable piece of monstrous shit is telling them to do for him, guys. Isn't this classic tribal hypocrisy in your fucking face? He's saying they're detestable and their gods are detestable, but look what this son of a bitch is telling them to do. Kill them all, show mercy to none. That's not evil and detestable, right? Do not do those detestable things so that you would not sin against the Lord your God. So according to the Yahweh prick, you don't sin against him as long as you kill for him. You don't kill for him, that's sinning against him. Holy horseshit. Bible dupes. Are you able to finally get your head out of your ass now? Here's another one. 1 Samuel 15, verse 2 and 3. Now go, attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women. children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. Kill every fucking thing that moves. Because I, unlike the evil god of these heathen that I'm having you attack, am a loving and just and merciful and tender and endearing god. All the bullshit's fucking meter is going off the charts now, isn't it? He's loving and merciful? Are you daft, Bible dupes? Are you that far gone? Has this thing sunk its fucking clutches into you so deep that you cannot see what's plainly before your eyes? This book is toxic sludge, ladies and gentlemen. It's deadly. It's so deceitful. It's so fucking full of shit. I don't care how many passages you want to throw out there that say that God is loving and merciful. For every 10 passages, and that's probably all that there are, for every 10 passages you can throw out there like that, I'll throw 1,000 back at you that say otherwise. But we have a big problem here with the preponderance of evidence, don't we? Isn't it obvious that those 10 or so passages that portray the prick as loving have to be damage control when you've got the overwhelming bulk of the rest of the fucking book telling you otherwise? And forget passages that call him loving and merciful. Look at the ones that describe his actions. Obviously, he can't be loving and merciful when his actions betray that fucking claim. Why does this have to be explained to people? But then again, I was once one of those dumbasses myself who needed to have it explained to me. How did I fall for this shit? I don't know. I honestly don't. Had my head up my ass, obviously. So glad it's out now, but boy, was it in there for a long fucking time.
I'm surprised I was able to breathe all those years.
Anyway, let's look at some other interesting dimensions of this. Pick up there with the bad guys.
Most of you are already aware that the sick freaks ruling our world are engaged in some of the most horrific crimes against children imaginable. This dark and depraved underground is something any healthy person would not even want to consider. But we must investigate their operations and expose these criminals to the light of day so that justice might be done. The recent Pizzagate revelations are just the tip of a massive iceberg. Watch The Big Picture, Pizzagate and Beyond. Learn the terrifying truth at beyondpizzagate.com.
All right, guys, welcome back. Already in our final segment here. So let's look at some other interesting aspects behind the Canaanite and Hebrew relations at this time. Here's the ultimate irony. Even though the Old Testament denounced the Canaanites and the people of Uber on a regular basis, the Hebrews borrowed, or should I say stole, a great many ideas from Ugarit, from the Canaanites in general. Here's some key examples. The chief Canaanite god, of course, was named El, which was one of the main names or titles of Yahweh, was, is, right? They stole one of the main names of their god from the Canaanites. Here they are denouncing the Canaanites and their deities, and yet their chief deity had his name stolen and applied to their god. More specifically, the Canaanites used other titles for this god, which were also commonly used by the Hebes, such as El Shaddai, El Elyon, and El Barith. All of these names, El Shaddai especially. Any Bible dupe is well familiar with that, but it turns out, guys, that exact name, that exact title was applied to the Canaanite deity, El. Imagine that, El Shaddai. Anyway. Baal was another important Ugaritic deity or Canaanite deity. And even though the Hebes didn't use this title for their god, they certainly applied the exact same attributes of Bel or Baal to Yahweh, such as his status as creator of all things. That's interesting because, you know, Bible dupes are often under the impression that of all the ancient gods of the ancient world, you know, only Yahweh is the one who claimed to be the creator. You know, there were gods that were said to have lorded over different aspects of life or different aspects of the universe, but none of them were said to be the creator. That's bullshit. Another lie that they fall for, because they want to have you think that their religion has originality to it and authenticity somehow with that idea of originality. It's not original. It's not authentic. It's all plagiarized. All of it. Nothing unique about that book, about that god, and his role as creator. And by the way, it's not just Baal. There were many other ancient gods that were said to be the chief deity, the creator deity. So out the window goes that. But they probably directly borrowed that attribute right from Baal, because that's where they originated, and they stole a lot of ideas from the Canaanites. One Ugaritic text says this about Baal: "Indeed, our creator is the eternal. Indeed, the everlasting is he who brought us into being. Our king is Baal, our sovereign, second to none." Does this not sound like a hymn addressed to Yahweh in the book of Psalms? Of course it does. Is not Yahweh hailed with the titles of eternal and everlasting? Is he not called sovereign Lord and creator of all things? And is he not also alleged to be the one who brought us into being? Same terminologies. Understand that this text long preceded the writing of the Old Testament. So it's not the Old Testament played. It's not the Canaanites plagiarizing the Old Testament. There's many parallels between hymns to Yahweh and Baal, as it turns out. One hymn to Baal states, quote, "Now too the seasons of his rains will Baal observe, the seasons with snow, and he will peal his thunder in the clouds, flashing his lightnings to the earth." And here is what was concurrently stated about Yahweh in Job 37:5 and Psalm 29, verse 7. Listen to this. And here is what was concurrently stated. Read the same. Sorry about that. God's voice, this is the Job passage. God's voice is glorious in thunder. We can't even imagine the greatness of his power. The voice of the Lord strikes with flashes of lightning. You see the same imagery here, right? The God of the sky, that's what Baal was, the flasher of lightning thunders his voice. And then here's another example from a Ugaritic Baal text, which proclaims, "Let me tell you, Prince Baal, let me repeat, rider on the clouds. Now your enemy, Baal, now you will kill your enemy. Now you will annihilate your foe. You will take your eternal kingship, your dominion forever and ever." Not your enemy, Baal, your enemy, comma, Baal, comma. In other words, your enemy, Baal, you will kill, blah, blah, blah. Okay, anyway. Compare that with what we find in Psalm 92:9 and then 145, verse 13. "Behold your enemies, Yahweh, behold your enemies. They have perished. All evildoers have been scattered. Your kingdom is an eternal kingdom. Your rule is forever." Almost the same exact wording, and it's referring here to your enemies, just like the Baal text, guys. It's almost word for word. Baal, amongst other things, was considered, as I just said, a sky deity, as the last two Baal passages reveal. The same sky god imagery, of course, was applied to Yahweh. We just saw one verse along that line. Well, here's some more. Job 22:14 says, "Clouds are a hiding place for him, Yahweh, so that he cannot see, and he walks on the vault of heaven." Here's another one, Job 37:15 and 16. "Do you know how God establishes them and makes the lightning of his cloud to shine? Do you know about the layers of the thick clouds, the wonders of one perfect in knowledge?" And then here's another one, the final one here, Job 26:9. "He obscures the face of the full moon and spreads his cloud over it." I got several more here, but it's not necessary to go through all this. You got the point. Same exact imagery applied to Baal was applied to Yahweh, just like the same name, El and El Shaddai, was applied to the prick. But yet they condemned the gods of the Canaanites. In addition to Baal being fashioned as a sky deity, he was also revealed as a volcano god, as was the case with many other ancient chief deities. And I don't even have to read this. You guys might recall, they did a show on this a while back, Yahweh, the volcano god. I can just skip over this. You get the point. Let's see. I'm just going to skip right past this. Two other important Canaanite gods worshipped in Ugarit were Yam, the god of the sea, and Mot, the god of death. Interestingly, the Hebrew word for sea is yam, and the Hebrew word for death is mot. Now, isn't that interesting? They took the names of these gods, stole them, included them in their language, and the meaning of them is what those two gods were the gods of. How do you like them apples, ladies and gentlemen? But perhaps most shocking of all, is the fact that the Ugaritic texts actually mention Yahweh as the son of El. One text states, "The name of the son of God, El, Yahweh." The name of the son of God, which is the word God there is, El. So the name of the son of El, comma, Yahweh. How do you like that, guys? So they had a god named El and a god named Yahweh, just like the Shasu. So were the Shasu the Hebes? Did they precede the Hebes? Did the Shasu, who may have been the Hebes, precede the Canaanites? Nobody can really say. But the Shasu also worshipped a god named Yahweh. So it's possible Canaanites got that name from the Shasu, which were the Hebes. So maybe they didn't steal Yahweh. It's really hard to tell. But they certainly got El from them. The Hebes didn't have a god named El until they came in contact later with the Canaanites. Ugaritic texts mention a hero by the name of Dan Il, D-A-N, and then I-L. Was this the source of the Hebrew hero figure named Daniel? Ugaritic texts mention a mighty mythological creature called Leviathan. This creature is also mentioned in Isaiah 27:1 and Psalm 74:13 and 14 by name. And in a few other psalms, a couple of places in Job, whatever. But that was a uniquely Canaanite name of a mythological creature, right? A serpentine creature. It's mentioned, guys, in several books of the Bible as though it's a real creature. Yet another interesting parallel between ancient Israel and Ugarit is the yearly ritual known as the sending out of the scapegoats, one for God and one for a demon. The biblical text which relates this procedure is Leviticus 16, 1-34. This is the ceremony that was observed, I've mentioned this before, some of you might recall, on what's called, the Day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur, its modern name for it, where two goats were selected. One was Azazel, that was the one that the sins were confessed over, and then it was later released into the wilderness. And the other one was sacrificed after the sins were confessed over it. But the point here is, this yearly ceremony involved two goats. Well, they got that from the Canaanites, guys. They had a very similar annual ceremony involving two goats. How do you like that? It's all stolen. It's all plagiarized. But again, I'm pointing this out because you got to marvel. They hated the Canaanites so much. The Canaanites were so evil. But yet, they fucking stole everything from them, guys. The names of their gods, their religious practices and ceremonies and holy days. My God, man. Stole a lot of their words. Furthermore, the people of Ugarit worshipped their dead ancestors. These dead ancestors were known among both the Canaanites and Israelites as Rephaim. Along this line, notice what we read in Isaiah 14, verse 9. Sheol, or the grave. The grave beneath is stirred up to meet you when you come. It rouses the Rephaim, the dead ancestors, to greet you. All who were leaders of the earth, it raises from their thrones all who were kings of the nations. You see what's going on here? It's using the same word that the Canaanites used in the same fucking context. Ask a Bible dupe to explain that to you. Show them that passage, folks. Isaiah 14:9. What exactly is this Rephaim that the dead Hebrews were supposed to meet, in the afterlife? The hell kind of horseshit is that, guys? Most Bible dupes interpret Rephaim to be a form of giants, and to some degree they were in the Torah. There was the Nephilim, and then there was the Rephaim, who are referred to as giants. That seems to have been a Hebraic twist that was given to the word early on. But here, later in the book of Isaiah, the original meaning of the word Rephaim is used here. I mean, this word is used with the original application, the original Canaanite application of being dead loved ones. Isn't that interesting? You certainly can't apply the the Torah interpretation of giants in this verse, that when you die, you're gonna meet the giants? The fuck is that? No, this is talking about the same, you know, the same connotation that this word was used with the Canaanites. It's important to point out that there were two camps of Israelites who thought in totally different ways about the Canaanites. One school, the fanatical Mosaic type, did not want any fraternizing with the Canaanites in any way, while the other, more liberal types, felt that infiltration and intermarrying was the way to overcome them, initially, anyway. The following passage glaringly illustrates this dichotomy. This is from Judges, chapter 3, verses 5 to 7. It says, the sons of Israel lived among the Canaanites, took their daughters for themselves as wives, and gave their own daughters to their sons, and served their gods. The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and forgot the Lord their God, and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. Isn't that interesting, guys? Remember, this passage is later on where Yahweh is commanding them, do not intermarry with the Canaanites, right? But here it's admitting that they were doing it on a grand scale. So there was a split. Some thought, hey, no, we can muscle in on their trade networks. You know, fuck that. Why kill them? They already got an established trade network. Early on, the tribe didn't have that until they befriended, coerced the Phoenicians. But early on, there were those among them, the non-religious ones, that were saying, no, we need to befriend these guys, muscle in on their turf. You know, this is going to give us an edge with trade in the area. But the more fanatical Mosaic religious type was saying no. And this dichotomy has always existed with the tribe. You know, in the Middle Ages, you had the Messianic split between the, you know, that started with Jesus and John the Baptist, right? You had the royal and the priestly bloodline. You had that even before that, but it wasn't such an obnoxious, antagonistic split as it became in the Christian era. But there's always been this split. But one thing they've always agreed on, even though they've had their differences, they've always agreed that they are the superior ones, and that all other peoples will put it to serve them and to be used by them as the little toys, and that it's okay to kill them and enslave them and charge usury to them. And fuck you. Fuck you and all your philosophies. I don't care how much you differ on the little minor points, and they are minor. They're all the same, guys, when it comes out in the wash. They're all fucking evil, monstrous criminals on a scale that boggles the mind. You can't even wrap your head around it. I never cease to be amazed at how fucking evil they are. The more I study, it just makes my head spin. Can't get your head around it. It's like trying to comprehend how vast the universe is or what the highest number is you can count to. You can't do it. It's just, there is no highest number. You can't comprehend how evil they are because there's no limits to their evil. There isn't. In scope, in magnitude, degree of degradation, they know no bounds, guys. They're probably frustrated with themselves that they can't reach the ultimate level of evil. They're always trying to outdo themselves, and they know that it's just not evil enough. It's never shockingly evil enough for them. Each generation, they try to outdo the last one. That's what makes them proud. If we can fuck over people worse and on a greater scale, greater in magnitude, greater in number. Just look at the Bushes, guys, who, of course, do have tribal blood. All these fucking White House occupiers do. Daddy Bush, as I've said before, set a record, right? Under his presidency, he raped and pillaged this country on a scale that rivaled all previous presidents combined. But then when Junior came along, what did he do? He beat Daddy's record, which made Daddy very proud of Junior. He raped this country, rose the national debt to a level higher than what had been done under all previous presidents combined, including Daddy. And now we might be looking at another one of those pricks. Maybe Jebby Boy. And you bet if he gets in there, he's going to beat Junior's record too, guys. If he runs, I hate to say it, but he will get in. They'll see to that. Doesn't matter who else. He can even have Hillary run. They would prefer him over her any day. He would be their bitch. You better believe. If that son of a bitch runs, he's going to win. Doesn't matter what the fucking polls say. I mean, what the actual voting turnout is. I won't make a fucking frog's fat ass bit of difference. He'll get in. And that'll be the final tipping point right there. That'll be what pushes us over the edge. If, in fact, it doesn't happen under this son of a bitch. Saying right along, I hope I'm wrong, but I think something major is coming under this bastard, guys. We got 2 more years left of this prick, at least. Hope I'm wrong, but to think that there's still a lot of truth is that are holding out for this guy. Oh my God, man! How can you not see what's right in front of your face? Just take a whiff of his Jew ass breath, man. He's been licking their bare ass from day one. God damn it. How does that not tell you something? I'm not just talking the non-Jew-wise truth movement. I'm talking the Jew-wise truth movement. There's some among them who aren't getting it. Anyways, that does conclude. Wow, this is the first time I've finished one set of notes in one show in a long time. That concludes our discussion on the Ugarit takedown. So now, anyways, that concludes our series on, you know, the demise of the Bronze Age. Isn't it incredible, though, guys, the scope of it all, the magnitude on a global scale this crap was going on, all within 20 years, most of it within just a couple of years, but when you add the Americas and China, you know, it's probably about 20 years it span. But all these civilizations around the world being taken down, this gave them a tremendous monopolistic control. Didn't set up the Jew World Order the way they wanted, at the time. But it did give them a powerful, powerful economic edge. One which they've never really lost ever since. Ever since that time, guys, they have had control. Been a few goy that have gotten in the mix, but a great many of them, just like today, became tribal ass lickers to get in there and to maintain any footing that they got, kissing their ass, giving them their share of the pie, and making sure they didn't step on their toes or they'd crush them out. This has been a monopoly they have enjoyed. Sometimes, you know, it got weakened a little here and there, but essentially, they've maintained it nonstop ever since. The Bronze Age demise gave them a fucking world monetary monopoly, guys, that they've enjoyed ever since, and it has grown ever stronger in the last several centuries since the creation of the Bank of England. Exponentially stronger, to the point now where there really is no more effective resistance. It's all they've fucking hijacked all the significant countries in the world, folks. Significant militarily, economically, they've got them in their goddamn pocket, which is why any turning around of this shit, it's got to take place at the hands of the masses now. Forget thinking you've got anybody in government that's going to fuck all that, man. It's gone. You know, maybe there might be a few in the military that might rise up if they see the people rising up. I don't know. You can only hope. But political leaders, they're gone, guys. They had them hijacked a long time ago. Christ, this country was started by these motherfuckers. And by the way, I mentioned this before. I've got some more really good stuff coming up. I'm not sure if I'm going to do that next week. Got so many topics I want to get to that I've been wanting to get around to, but I do have a series of 2, I think even 3 more on the founding fathers, the early revolutionary period, absolutely fascinating stuff. I can't wait to get to that. But before I even do that, I think I'm going to cover a couple of other things. I've had some requests, you know, people asking me to do this and that, you know, cover this and that topic. One guy asked me to repeat a show that I did so long ago, and it wasn't even on any of the major networks I've been on. I think it was actually on a network once called the Paranormal Radio Network, if you can believe that. I'm not into the fucking paranormal, but I was offered a spot on there years ago. So I said, what the hell, why not? And I think that's the only network I ever covered this particular subject on. So probably most of you never heard it. I don't think it ever made it into any of my archives or anything. So I'll probably be doing that next week along with a couple of other things. And then after that, I think I'm going to get into the series on the Founding Fathers again, some more stuff I uncovered. Mind-blowing shit. Should you have any remaining doubts that they were a bunch of sellout bastards, this should be the final nail in the coffin on that. No, guys, they were absolute. Oh, there were a few, no doubt. You know, Patrick Henry. There were a few that were anti-federalists that definitely did want freedom, and, you know. But all the major players, no. They had no interest in your freedom at all. They were every bit the enslavers as the son of a bitches that occupy the White House today. And the Capitol building, and on it goes. They never, ever intended for this country, to be a free republic. Always intended for all power to be concentrated in Washington, and to have you reduced to abject poverty, and to create a fucking global empire. That was always their intention. I've already read in the past numerous quotes from several founding fathers, including Washington himself, that mentioned the word empire. Washington said, "We have created an empire in its infancy. Soon it will engulf the whole world." He actually fucking said that. Son of a bitch. Anyway, so, yeah, and that concludes our show for tonight. So on Wednesday, I'll pick up with one of these three topics. I don't know which one it'll be yet, but it'll be good. Good stuff coming up. Have a great... not Wednesday. Thursday. I'm sorry, guys. Not Wednesday. I will not be doing a live show Wednesday. So I'll see you guys on, most likely on Thursday. All right. Take care, folks. Have a good weekend.
Money, government, media, and academia. Repeat.
Jews are poor. The government and media are anti-Semitic.
Hola! You've just heard Chosen, one of the oldest languages known to ape. Try another. Mayenta is fat, ugly, and Sephardi.
My wife is beautiful, intelligent, and spiritual.
Good job! We have Chosen learning pods in synagogues, lodges, even selected pizza restaurants. Learn Chosen and stay ahead.
Vaccines are safe. The Holocaust was real.
So fluent, so chosen. Fees, obligations, and genital mutilation apply.